Hey, everybody, I'm Chris Mannix from The Vertical, and welcome to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, where I check in with some of the top players, coaches, and analysts covering the NBA. It's extension week in the league, and I sit down with The Vertical front office insider Bobby Marks and ask him about the whopping nine-figure contracts young big men like Rudy Gobert and Steven Adams are getting.
A lot of it is that you can lock them up to a four-year contract. You won't let them go out into free agency and get an offer. And we don't know where these rules might change. You might have a 24-hour window from a matching standpoint. So to get one of these players locked up, at least it gives you some security.
Plus, we go around the NBA and dive into what's behind Golden State's sluggish start.
You're basically just getting an up-and-down game, and you don't put an emphasis on defense. They'll be able to outscore teams. That's not going to be the issue. The other thing that sticks out is that, for at least for the first few games, they don't want to get their hands dirty here.
All that and more coming up next on The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Well, welcome back to another episode of The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We are roughly 1 week into the NBA season, and there's a lot I want to get to about this season, but we have also come across the end of extension deadline, if you want to call it that, where guys that are eligible for contract extension either get them or they don't. And there's a lot of big numbers that were thrown around on Monday as the deadline approached. Talk more about that. Bring in Bobby Marks, the front office insider over the Vertical, a guy that's been a part of many of these negotiations as the former assistant general manager with the Brooklyn Nets. Bobby, let me ask you about that first. You know, a lot of these guys getting extensions, in fact, I think all of them, really, they're restricted free agents at the end of the year. What is the upside for a team to give a Rudy Gobert a four-year, $100 million-plus deal, a Steven Adams a four-year, $100 million-plus deal, when the reality is they have a lot of control over that player next summer?
Well, when you look at Oklahoma City, they're going to, you know, have a little bit of an impact from this CBA potentially with the cap hold going up, at least with the Oladipo contract, and they were going to lose some room from there. And his starting number for his extension will be right around where his cap hold will be. The other players, you're right, with Adams, Gobert, even Gorgui Dieng in Minnesota, their salary for next year is going to probably double or at least triple in some cases what their actual, you know, cap hit is right now. And a lot of it is that you can lock them up to a four-year contract. You won't let them go out into free agency and get an offer. And we don't know where these rules might change. You might have a 24-hour window from a matching standpoint. So to get one of these players locked up, not a great free agent class once you get past some of these big names. At least it gives you some security.
You know, you mentioned Oklahoma City, and they did give Victor Oladipo $84 million over 4 years. They did give Steven Adams just over $100 million over 4 years. That seems to gobble up a lot or all of their cap space for next summer. We had speculated that maybe Blake Griffin could be on Oklahoma City's radar next summer if the Clippers fade out and Griffin's looking to come back to Oklahoma where he played his college ball. Does this take them out of the running for that? Or is there some kind of salary gymnastics they could potentially do to put themselves in the position to get him?
Well, Chris, we've seen in the past teams can, if you don't have cap space, you certainly can create it. We saw it with, we've seen it with San Antonio the last couple of years, with last year when they were able to get Aldridge, and this year with Pau Gasol. With Oklahoma City, they would have had to move a big name if it was an Enes Kanter, or, you know, to create some room, possibly, you know, get that max slot. Now you're locked into Adams and, you know, in Oladipo. You can certainly create room, but you also have to look at Sam Presti's track history. He's never gone out and signed a big-named free agent. I think the biggest name he's signed from a salary standpoint has been Anthony Morrow. So this team has been built through the draft. It's been built through the trades. We saw at the June draft getting Domantas Sabonis and Ilyasova and Oladipo also. So, you know, to speculate that, you know, they were going to be a big player in free agency when Sam has never gone out and you know, kind of went free agent shopping, he gets his business done right now. If there is an opportunity, I'm sure he'll be able to create some room.
You know, I look at these extensions, Bobby, the ones that got done on Monday. Rudy Gobert, the 4 years, $100 million. Adams and Oladipo, as I mentioned. You know, I mean, these are big numbers, of course, but I didn't look at any of these and say, wow, that guy is getting really overpaid. Even Gorgui Dieng at $64 million. It's a huge number, but when you think about what he's probably going to be in Minnesota and the fact that with Nikola Pekovic potentially never playing again out there, that's for today's market kind of reasonable. Did any of these extensions take you aback?
No, they didn't. And you know, if anything, I think we saw last week with the Dennis Schroeder extension. That's a, you know, that is a fair market deal where that number comes in at right at 15.5. He's got about $8 million in incentives, but those incentives are for making the All-Star game and if Atlanta wins the championship. So those are something you if you're Hawk ownership, you want to pay out. But no, I think what we saw this past summer with all these free agents, the numbers that came across, I don't think any of these rookie extension players who sign long four-year contracts, none of the numbers jump out. They're where the market is right now and you know where they're locked up. Yet where free agency was going to be next year too. You look at Gobert, Adams, Jang. You know they're looking. That's 2, 3, 4 probably as far as when you look at from that center class.
We don't know what the new collective bargaining agreement is going to look like when it's hopefully done before we get to next summer. But how big a variable is that? Do you think in the minds of general managers right now as they decide whether or not to offer these guys extensions?
It's a little bit of a, I guess, a snafu. I mean, you put that in, you're kind of going into the extension talks with blinders on. You know, hopefully you can get some dialogue from the league. But, you know, the league and the player association have really played a close hand as far as what is out there from the framework of a deal. So I think if you can get a deal done, you don't worry about what the CBA is going to be. There are certain GMs that like to, you know, let the market dictate as far as from a restricted free agency. There are some that are overly protective of cap space. I think you can make the case up in Boston with, you know, with Danny Ainge. He's never been a big, you know, believer, I guess, in extensions. I think Rondo is the last one there to do so, and they'll go into free agency next year with room, you know, with, you know, Olynyk, you know, as a restricted free agent. So I think it's more about where the track record is of each GM, and if you can get a deal done and there's some middle ground with an agent, you do so.
All right, let's talk about this week, because a lot of interesting early season storylines kind of came out of it. And I want to start out in Golden State, where everyone's attention is kind of focused right now. You know, offensively, any issues they may have, they're easily worked out. Defensively, I wonder how significant the concerns are with the Warriors, because if you know, everyone was always so locked in their three-point shooting and how they played the free-flowing offensive style. The last 2 years, Golden State has been a top-five defensive team in terms of efficiency. Right now, they're 26th in the NBA in team defense. How concerned would you be if you were in Golden State about the way they've defended to start the season?
I would be a little bit. I think we're still at a small of a, you know, sample of games. I usually look at it, you know, 8 to 10 game window as far as where we can kind of put some numbers with each team. You know, a couple things that stick out, and I think when you watch the Phoenix game from you know over the weekend, you watch that first half and it looked like an All-Star game. Mm. And you can do that against some of the, you know, teams like that, New Orleans, you know, over the weekend also. But when you play some of these teams this week, the Oklahoma Cities of the world, you're not going to be able to do so. And that's my concern, is that you're basically just getting an up and down game and you don't put an emphasis on defense. They'll be able to outscore teams. That's not going to be the issue. The other thing that sticks out is that, for at least for the first few games, they don't want to get their hands dirty here. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. They have not drawn a charge at all in the first, you know, first couple games here. So that's something that sticks out. It's a little bit different than that 2010-11 Miami team that came together, because that team defensively was fine. They just couldn't score off the bat. So a little bit of a small sample right here, but there are certain, I won't say red flags, but you know, it's certainly somewhere in between.
Yeah, I understand that when you put a team like this together, you have to expect some bumps along the way. Miami was evidence of that. Not every team, in fact, most teams are not going to be Boston from 07-08 and jump out of the gate with a new group at, well, like 22-3 or some ungodly number that they started the season. You've got to adjust. And despite the fact that several of these players played together with USA Basketball, there's going to be an adjustment period here. That said, I look at the roster, Bobby, and there are some real holes there. I mean, last year, if they had the same team as last year and they got off to the start and they weren't defending, at the very least, I could say, all right, Andrew Bogut's there. He's a defensive presence in the middle. He'll defend. He'll rebound. They'll be fine. Festus Ezeli, decent at that end of the floor as well with rebounding. they'll be fine. This year, I just look at their bigs, and it's wholly unimpressive. I mean, Zaza Pachulia, look, he's going to be okay to start the season, but as we saw last year with Dallas, when his numbers totally cratered after the All-Star break, he's a concern to me. JaVale McGee, massive concern to me. David West at 36, what can you really expect from him? I just don't know if they have the horses this year to become anywhere close to the type of defensive team they were last year.
Well, you also look at the minutes these guys have played right now. You look at the top four players with Durant, Curry, Thompson, Green. They're all averaging close to at least 35 minutes a night. So what is the workload going to be? And it's a little bit different in the early part of the season when games are a little bit spread out. But when you start piling up the games here and you get some more back-to-backs, there is certainly going to be some more due stress here. And you're right. You've got McCaw is out with an injury right now. Your center position is Pachulia, and I guess McGee, he's seen a little bit of time. You know, David West is shooting in the high 30s from a field standpoint. He hasn't given you much. Ian Clark, that's your bench there, as well, along with Livingston and Iguodala. So it's not a matter of your big four. It's a matter of, can the big four hold up playing these minutes right now?
Yeah, I think their bench is going to be okay. I think they'll get it together there. And I'm a big fan of Patrick McCaw once he's able to kind of get it going. He was really good at Summer League, and I think he's going to be a rotation player for them this season. But again, that front line would worry me, especially, I mean, you look at the Western Conference. What do you see out there? You see power. You know, teams that play Powerball in the West. San Antonio, they beat Golden State. They play Powerball. Oklahoma City, they have big front line still with Steven Adams. The Clippers, they speak for themselves. Utah, if they're in the mix, they play big. There are a lot of teams that are going to be considered, Golden State's peers, or at least their competition in the West, that are just, they're capable of going big against them. And if they don't have to match down, I think that's going to be a real problem for the Warriors.
Well, you look at, the first couple of games here, they're averaging at least 50 points per night, giving up points in the paint. And you look at Gasol and Aldridge, Anthony Davis, Chandler and Alex Len, those are big teams right there. And that's the concern. And they're giving up a lot of points besides in the point right at the rim. I think they're letting teams shoot about 60% there. So there is not that rim protector right now. And I think last year you might have been able to disguise with different schemes, and you're just not a lot, able to do that right now.
How about San Antonio, though? I mean, they come out and they just spank Golden State on an opening night. They pick up three more wins, albeit against, lesser competition, Sacramento, New Orleans, and Miami. They're already resting guys, which is hilarious at the early start of the season. But man, Kawhi Leonard, if he's not an MVP candidate this year, he's going to be within the next year. He keeps layering stuff onto his game. He came in as an elite defender, kind of a corner shooter, added a three-point shot to his game. Now he's basically a sharpshooter. And you see early in the season, in addition to like a post game, he's got that kind of Kobe step back stuff going on out there right now. I mean, this guy, he's a stud, Bobby. I don't know how high you are on Kawhi Leonard, the total package there, but I look at him as being right in the mix for MVP this season.
Well, when you watch him play now and you watch end of quarters or in end of games, and and this is not really Pop's, MO, is that they basically just run ISO with him and put the ball in his hand, get it out of the point guard, out of either Mills or Parker. And I think you saw that the other night in Miami, where it's one-on-one, and he has really redefined his game. He's always been that defensive stopper, but from an offensive standpoint, there have been a little bit of question marks, but for what he's done the early part of the season from an overall game, I know Westbrook and Anthony Davis numbers are stand out at you, but from a complete overall game, he's been the best player right now.
All right, you mentioned Westbrook and Davis. I want to get into them because we're seeing, in some ways, what we kind of expected to see from Russell Westbrook, just these eye-popping numbers and incredibly high usage rate. I mean, the number of shots he's taking and the time he spends with the ball in his hands are astronomical to start the season. Anthony Davis, 95 points in the first two games for the Pelicans, who just are bad, frankly, but not helping him out in that way on that end. But, I mean, which of these two players, Westbrook and Davis, who are you more impressed by?
Well, it's Westbrook because, you know, from a they've won a bunch of games in New Orleans hasn't. I think you look at that. I think when you look at
barely though. I mean, they're,
barely. Yeah. They're, and that's the thing. And it will and I think it could catch up to Oklahoma City here. You look at the teams that Oklahoma City played versus the teams that New Orleans played. You know, you look at the San Antonios of the world, the, you know, the Golden States of the world that Davis has had to face. And for Westbrook and Oklahoma City, it's been, you know, the Lakers, it's been Phoenix, it's been Philadelphia. So that's a little bit of a concern for Oklahoma City long term. But you're right, from a usage standpoint, Westbrook is like that 2014-15 season when Durant missed most of that year. And with Davis, it's just more of his supporting cast. And I know that Holiday is out and Evans and Pondexter, but who else is going to step up there? And I think with Tim Frazier and Etuan Moore, I think you're getting the most out of them right now. But those guys are role players. And can you get something out of Solomon Hill? He's shooting, you know, in the 20%. You know, your bigs aren't even playing, you know, with Ajinka and Omer Asik. Is there another player on that team that can kind of step up and help Davis out? At least with Westbrook, you have Oladipo, you've got Adams, you've got Roberson, you've got Cantor. So there are players that, you know, that can ride along with Westbrook. I think with Davis, that's where the shortcomings are.
Well, two things off that. Number one, they get what they deserve with Solomon Hill. I mean, you pay him $53 million after Indiana says, no, we're just going to pass on your option for that last year. What did you expect? I mean, I never thought that. I thought that was one of the worst deals of the offseason, and it's
Chris. You know
like
what? You know what that is? That is when you draft a player after he has a good NCAA tournament.
Yeah,
that's what that is.
And, Derek Williams.
And he had a good, you know, he had a good first round against Toronto. But what, you know, they didn't. And I always say, when a team does not pick up your option, that is a red flag for me right off the bat. I don't care what that player does, because you always have to kind of light a fire under his butt to get him going. And why do you want to do that every time? So that's a big concern for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other part of that, of what you were talking about, is with Oklahoma City, is I would like to see Westbrook do even more to get Steven Adams involved in the offense. Because, you know, I remember watching Steven Adams when he was coming out of high school or out of New Zealand into the NBA, and he looked like a surefire top five or top six pick coming out. He had all the moves. Then he went to Pittsburgh, and I don't know what happened there. It just seemed like he was always playing kind of out of position in some ways. But in his few years in Oklahoma City, you're seeing the old Steven Adams, this guy with this diverse skill set who can do, you know, pretty much anything on both ends of the floor. And he's had some really good games start the season, 14 and 12 against the Lakers, 16 points against Philadelphia. I'd like to see his shots go up even more. I mean, I'd like to see this guy consistently getting 15 to 20 shots every single night, because I think he can handle the load.
No, you're right. And I think when you go back and look at him at Pittsburgh, and I saw him a bunch, and I saw him at the Garden, I think it was in the Big East tournament, and I was like, who is this guy? Yeah. I mean, he's a lottery pick, people are saying. And you look at back from when he was, you know, in college, he averaged 5 shots a game. You know, 7 points.
He was playing high post. Like, it was weird watching him at, like, the elbow extended. Like, this guy's a beast. Put him on the block.
Yeah, he was not, you know, and that's the thing, when there are certain players, because of the style they play in college, they turn out to be better pros. And then I think that's the case with Adams. And he is your second best player, in all due respect to Oladipo. And I think you can start to play through him a little bit more. And that's something that, you know, from a we didn't see that much because of how much Durant and Westbrook kind of dominated the ball, and I think you're starting to see that a little bit more here.
All right, looking at the competition out east, it's once again Cleveland and then, you know, kind of everybody else at the moment. Cavaliers 3-0 to start the season. I mean, there's no controversy out there right now. There's no issues now that J.R. Smith is back in the lineup. I guess if you want to kind of nitpick, you can say, are they going to go get a backup point guard to replace Dellavedova? Are they going to be okay with Kay Felder out there? But they just look like the team we saw last year, Bobby, and I don't see any reason to believe this group's not going to storm through the Eastern Conference this year.
You're right, and the one thing too, you look at their schedule in the next 2 weeks, they don't have a back-to-back, so they're going to be well-rested here, and I know the games that, you know, league has tried to space them out a little bit more here, but if you look at how the schedule is and how their minutes are, and outside of, you know, that Orlando game when the Magic came back, you know, they're beating teams pretty good. And you're right, there's no adversity right now. Seems like everybody knows their role as far as from a, you know, from a starter and from a bench perspective. And if there is one thing that's kind of lingering, is, you know, is there a backup point guard out there to be had, you know, in case you want to monitor some of these players' minutes, you know, backup point guard and health. But I, when you look at how, at least in the first week of how the East has shaken up here a little bit, I think what you've seen is kind of what a lot of us predicted. You've got Cleveland, and then you've got teams like Boston, Toronto. You can put, you know, I guess Charlotte in the mix a little bit here. You know, Indiana's been a disappointment. Atlanta's been pretty good, at least off the bat. And then we've seen, you know, the Milwaukee's, the Brooklyn's, and, you know, New York. That's another conversation. But I think it's Cleveland, and then there's a big step, you know, from everyone else.
Yeah, and Boston I was pretty high on coming into the year. But Boston is in the bottom third of the NBA right now in rebounding differential. They're getting out rebounded by about four boards a game. That might not seem all that significant, but you watch this team play, and they're really having trouble with the solid rebounding teams. And it's another one of those situations, Bobby, where they lost, you know, two of their top rebounders last year. Jared Sullinger, I believe, was number one. Evan Turner was right there in the top four or five rebounders there. And for all that Al Horford can do, he's never really been an elite rebounder. In fact, the criticism of him last year with Atlanta was that he didn't rebound enough for that team. I mean, how big an issue do you see this being for the Celtics, who also don't have like that guy coming back that can be a high level rebounder?
Well, the one thing you don't want to do is give away extra possessions, and that will, you know, you'll pay dearly. Maybe not in the regular season, but you will pay dearly from a playoff standpoint. But no, you're right. He's averaging 5 rebounds a night right now. It's down from 7.2, and, you know, when he was in Atlanta. And I wonder how much of that, you know, did Millsap maybe, you know, disguise for Horford here? Is there another player out there that can kind of complement? When do you get a Linick back? But that is a concern if you're Boston, more for the long term than right now.
Yeah. You know, I think the Celtics believe that this could be the year they take kind of a step forward. And maybe getting Marcus Smart back is big for that. He'll rebound a little bit at that guard spot, but that's something I think they've got to, if they hope to be any kind of threat to Cleveland, and I don't know that they really are, but if they hope to be that number two seed in the East, they've got to get their rebounding right. You mentioned Indiana, and I saw them play in Brooklyn on Friday, and man, that defense is terrible. That's a bad defense. I mean, that was, you know, under Frank Vogel, that was one of their calling cards. That was their hallmark. They were always a consistent top 10 defensive team. Most years they were top 1, 2, or 3 under Vogel. They changed the roster. They play up tempo, and look, they're scoring at times, and they look like a transition team at times, but, you know, they're not the Rockets or they're not the Warriors. You're not going to beat teams with that roster by outscoring them. I think their defense is a big problem right now.
Well, there's a couple things that stand out. You know, Jeff Teague has not played well at all.
Yeah.
I mean, he has been, and he was pretty good, I would say, not great in the preseason. So if you want to say, is there a carryover effect from Atlanta? Because you remember he wasn't great during that playoffs, and I think Schroeder came in and played down the stretch for here. So he has not been good. Rebounding has not been good. Their bench has not been good. And now you've got Stuckey out. Aaron Brooks has been out, you know, and I think when you look at how Indiana, at least the last, you know, 2 years, it's always been from a bench standpoint, you know, it's either Stuckey or CJ Miles. One of those two is always out for an extended time, and we don't know how long with Stuckey with the hamstring and everything. So the bench hasn't been great there. And then, you know, and then as you mentioned, you know, points given up, you can't get in a track meet. You don't have the offensive firepower, and you've got good players with, you know, with Thad Young and Miles Turner, of course, Paul George there. But to get in a track meet like you did maybe against Dallas, you could probably do that against Dallas and score 130 points. But to do it against some of these good teams, you know, the Chicago's and lose by, you know, 25, you know, 30 points, or even, you know, the night before in Brooklyn, you just can't do that.
Well, they don't have a lot of plus defenders out there too. I mean, Paul George is a very good defender, but I mean, look at that roster. I mean, how many other stoppers do they have there? Is there anybody you consider a high level defender on that team?
Well, not on your wings. It's Stuckey and Miles. That's your from a starting standpoint, it's Monte Ellis. So you don't have that lockdown defender as far as, you know, maybe put him on your best player. That is one thing that Indiana does not have. You know, you're okay with the bigs, you know, with Young and LaVoy Allen and Miles Turner and Jefferson. You're fine there, but from a wing standpoint, that's a deficiency.
Yeah, I always thought just the decision that Larry Bird made and just how kind of openly frustrated he was by how this team wasn't scoring enough points, going public you know, at the end of last season, saying this team wasn't scoring enough points. I mean, they didn't have the horses to do it. I mean, and I'm a staunch defender of Frank Vogel. I admit that. I mean, I think Frank is an excellent coach, and you know, once he gets a workable roster down there in Orlando, he'll be just fine. But you plug Nate McMillan to that mix and say we're going to play this style. I mean, that's why I question. A lot of people in the preseason were telling me that they thought Indiana could be a top four team in the Eastern Conference. I never saw it. There were just too many unknowns about this team, and you're seeing a lot of those unknowns, Bobby, kind of rear their heads right now.
Well, you're right, and I think a lot of it, when you look at, you know, at least for the first few games here, the Chicago game is glaring, because to get blown out, yeah, you know, I know it's a back-to-back, but that early in the season, that is a telling story. And it reminds me a lot of in that year in 13-14, we went down to Orlando, I think the third game of the year, and got our doors blown off. And that kind of, at least with me, it kind of raised a little bit of a red flag that this maybe is not what it's, you know, made out to be right now. Coming off I think we had come off a win against the Heat and everything. So those type of losses, you know, certainly I know it's very early in the year, but that tells you a little bit about the group here, especially coming off a loss to Brooklyn on Friday night, a bad loss there, to go out the next night and really get your doors blown off against a good Chicago team, but nothing, you know, it wasn't like you went into Cleveland here.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I think we've reached the point where we have to acknowledge how awesome Joel Embiid is. I mean, we just have
well, here
to.
You go, Chris. Here, I was going to tweet it out, but I didn't want all the GMs being mad at me. But mm-hmm. I was going to say, shoot, there's your guy for next year's GM server that you want to build your team around, Joel Embiid.
Number
right?
One,
he'll he'll replace Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Davis, and he'll, I'm sure he will be the number one choice for all these GMs.
I mean, he's unbelievable, though. Like the things he can do out there, you know, basically, he is a rookie. Having missed two consecutive years, what he's doing out there right now. I mean, I was talking to Mike Conley about this the other day, and Mike was saying that when they played Philadelphia in the preseason, he was watching Joel Embiid run the floor and defend, and he's like, man, that's Greg Oden. That's what Greg used to be out there. And I think he's obviously a much better offensive player than Greg Oden ever was. But, I mean, this guy's doing, like, dream shakes at the free throw line. He's knocking down three-pointers. He's showing post skills in addition to being already a pretty high-level defensive player. He had a block against Russell Westbrook where, I mean, he came from across the lane to block Westbrook, and Westbrook is an explosive player. I mean, there's not much this guy can't do. I agree with you. I think that, you know, by this time next year, we'll be talking about him on that top of that GM survey. But, I mean, I think we're now seeing exactly what everybody saw prior to the draft and why everyone was convinced that before that foot injury, Joel Embiid would have been number one overall easily.
No, you're exactly right. And you look back at what he did at Kansas, it's almost, you know, what he's doing right now. You know, he's, you know, in that year at, you know, the 13-14 season, you know, 11 points, you know, 8 rebounds in 23 minutes. And I know his points are up right now, but he's the player and probably more polished because he had 2 years, you know, with the injury to kind of, you know, redefine some things, you know, from his post game. His 3-point shooting has certainly got better. I think he attempted maybe like, you know, two or three, you know, 3-pointers in college. And now he's added that to his repertoire. And it's always going to be about health for him, you know, just a matter as far as staying healthy. I think they're doing exactly the right thing from a minutes restriction. There's no need to play him, you know, more than what they're doing right now. But the more you watch of him, I think by each game from what he did in, you know, the Oklahoma City game, I know the Atlanta game, they got their doors blown off and everything. But, you know, he's been everything that we probably thought for and even more since we saw him, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
I was at practice in Philadelphia last week, and at the end of practice, he was working with the small forwards on taking threes, and I didn't keep track of what he was making and what he wasn't, but he was making a lot of them. Like, and I think that's going to be a real big part of his repertoire, kind of moving forward. And if you have to defend him out there, a five, it's almost like what I think about Porzingis. I think that Porzingis might be a little bit better off the dribble than Embiid is, but he's got good handle and he can go to the basket. He is going to be tough to stop. My question for you is, having gone through the foot issue, a couple of foot issues with Brooke Lopez in Brooklyn, how cautious do you expect Philadelphia to be here? I mean, at what point do you think the Sixers kind of take the shackles off Embiid and say, look, you want to play 35? You can play 35 tonight.
Well, you have to rely on your strength and conditioning department as far as, and I think the trend that we've starting to see, and we even see with the Nets with Lopez holding him out on a back to back, is that we're relying more on analytics from a, you know, from a medical standpoint, from a strength and conditioning workload. And I think when you're looking at it from a, from the Philadelphia, if it's your doctors, and we'll probably see his workload from a minute standpoint increase. A lot of it's based on what your schedule looks like too. So that will be a key there. But, you know, where he is right now, I think he's in a good spot. I think it's almost like that new toy we, you know, someone gets at Christmas. You know, you want to put it together right away, but maybe you got to have a little bit of patience here. And I think that's where you got to be with Embiid.
Yeah, I agree. And there's no rush here. You're not making the playoffs or even sniffing the playoffs, not with, you know, your roster once again totally banged up and Ben Simmons probably not back until at least January. Maybe a little bit later than that. But you know, when they get all these guys healthy, there's a lot of talk about how they break up this kind of front court combination. When they get Noel back and when Jahlil Okafor can play a full workload, I mean, who's the guy that has to go there? I mean, I would assume it's Okafor because I think both Okafor and Embiid are centers, and whereas I think Noel's more of a four and can guard more fours. But is Okafor the guy that you think would eventually have to be moved? And if he is, how valuable do you see him on the trade block?
Well, he's got to get, you know, show, you know, from a health standpoint, and I know he's been limited and he's been nicked up, and then Noel is, you know, he's out, you know, right now with that knee. So yeah. It's back to where, you know, we talked about it, I think, early in the year. You know, you never could have enough good starting pitching, and, you know, we thought they had an influx of bigs, and now you're basically down to, I guess, 1.5 with, you know, Embiid and Okafor. So it's still a wait and see. They're both on these rookie contracts, and I know Noel will be a restricted, you know, free agent this summer, but I'm showing a lot of patience, and I'm going to try to build their stock up. You know, we don't know when Noel will be back. I know they said, you know, 4 to 6 weeks there or, with that, and, you know, and maybe see if there's value there. But it's hard from where they are from a contract standpoint. I know Philly's got a bunch of cap space right now they're sitting on to be able to get a deal done and really get, you know, true value. Are you going to look for more picks? You already have a bunch, you know, in the future. So that's going to be the big thing with Philadelphia right now.
So Philly's winless, but, you know, again, you don't expect a lot from them. Of the other teams that, as of Monday early evening, that are still winless, the Wizards, the Magic, out west, Minnesota, Dallas, Phoenix, New Orleans. Of that group of teams, you know, which one of them is should feel the most concerned about their start?
Well, Orlando, I would say, and it's just a matter
of
how
they've lost. They're giving up a lot of points. A lot of points out there.
Yeah, it's a matter of how they've lost some of these games. And I know you came back against Cleveland the other night, and I always say the bad teams give up these big leads and get down by a lot of points, and there's always a run in them, you know, either in the, you know, in the fourth quarter, and you make the game respectable and you wind up losing by 5 or 6 when you're down by 30 the whole game. That's a bad habit, and I think we see that a lot with some of these bad teams, and that's the one team that would concern me. Dallas, maybe a little bit. I don't know where this Nowitzki with, you know, he's got a little bit of an Achilles issue right now, you know, from a health standpoint. Barnes has been, you know, up and down. There's been some good moments. There's been some, you know, not some good moments, and I really thought Wes Matthews would kind of rebound from last year, and, you know, he goes 9 for 25 in a loss against Houston and everything. So if you're asking me right now, as far as those teams that have not, you know, have, I would say Orlando right now. You know, the Washington loss to Memphis the other night was brutal. I mean, you're up like 8 with like 2 minutes left, and you give up a 2 and then a flagrant, and it was like a 5-point play, or there was some kind of combination there. And that's a bad loss, you know, on the road for them.
Well, they look like, just stick with Orlando for a second, they look like a team that doesn't really trust each other, they're not making a lot of extra passes out there. It's a lot of one-on-one basketball, isolation type of basketball. They look like a team that needs another full month of training camp together to kind of get this right. And you look at their numbers, they're 20th in the NBA in assists right now, and that's not always the perfect indicator of ball movement, but if you look at the teams at the top, I mean, they've had much better a ball movement than Orlando. So I think that's a problem. But I've been a little surprised at how porous they've been defensively. They went out there and got all these bigs. Now, granted, not a lot of these bigs are rim protectors. Like, Vucevic is not a rim protector. I guess Biombo is to some degree. But, you know, everything that people kind of said about Orlando is kind of coming to fruition in some ways. There's too many bigs and not enough talent at the other positions.
Well, it's roster continuity, and it's a challenge when you kind of put a roster together. You spend a lot of money in the off season with Biombo and Green, and I know you bought Fournier back,
yep.
And you made the Ibaka trade in June. And it's, when you kind of try to put mesh all these players together, sometimes it takes a long time. And the product, what you see right now is not going to be the one you'll see in December. But do you have that much time to kind of go in one of these three and seven stretches during the year? And I think, when you look at where the league is right now, and you look at the game the other night in Denver, the Denver-Portland game, that would look like a game that was in late March, early April, just because both teams, basically the same roster intact. There's a trust level there. They're communicating both, on a defensive level, and it's a clean game. There's not much of lead changes or blowouts here, and that came down to the wire. And I think that's when you keep your team intact, that's what you're going to see in Orlando when you have so many moving pieces. And, what are you getting out of Elfrid Payton right now? That's a big question. You've been tinkering with Gordon. Is he a three or is he a four? And, and then you have, the Biombo Vucevic. So I think you're going to see some of these questions linger for Orlando until you can kind of figure out what your right mix is.
So you, on one of our vertical videos last week, you puffed your chest out and you said that Minnesota, you're not buying in to the Minnesota Timberwolves yet. And look, I'm taking people behind the curtain here. You texted me when the Wolves were up 18-1 on Memphis.
I said it was 20-3, and I said, Chris, you better take that video down.
And then how big a sigh of relief did you breathe when Memphis bounced back and took that game? I mean,
well, I was thinking of, and that's why I hate doing I never make predictions, and we can talk about buy and sell, and I think that's a little bit different, but when you make predictions, then you tend to start to root against teams here because, what you said. And I think what in Minnesota, they had big leads in Memphis. They had a big lead in Sacramento. And it's a lot of it. It's just growing pains. It's a matter of how to close games out. And my one concern with the Timberwolves, and we saw in the Sacramento games, is from a dominant standpoint, ball handler is with Andrew Wiggins. And I thought that was the ideal time. You had Rubio went out with an injury. I think he sprained his elbow. And then you bring Chris Dunn in, but you played Dunn off the ball, and you had Wiggins as the primary ball handler. Mm-hmm. And if you're auditioning for Dunn to be, and I know it's a close game and maybe that's not the right moment, but that would have been a good time to see what this kid has. But you're playing him off the ball. And, Towns, even when Cousins fouled out in that game, Towns didn't, he maybe had one shot at the end of the game. And that's going to be my concern is that, play through your best player here. And it certainly is Karl Anthony Towns.
All right, before we go, we have to say something about Chicago and what they've been able to do early on, because they were kind of uniformly predicted to not just, struggle, but be dysfunctional at some point during the season because of the personalities they brought in and Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade, the lack of three-point shooting there. They've been really good to start the year. Now, my question for you is when you watch the Bulls and look at some of the numbers, what stands out? I mean, do you look at the three-point shooting, which has been, better than expected, as something that's sustainable, or are we kind of seeing a mirage early on and the earlier thoughts about the Bulls are going to come to fruition?
It's a little bit of both. It's only been a couple of games. The one thing that stands out is McDermott right now as far as how well he's played and has really given that bench a big boost. And that was my big question with Chicago, outside of, from a shooter standpoint with Wade and Rondo and Butler, was what would this bench what could do. And it's basically littered with former first round picks and with Mirotić and McDermott. Now you've got Carter Williams. You've started to see something pretty good here, but it's still only a couple games. And I think if there's a little bit of an Achilles, it's going to be that bench as far as what type of consistent production you can be. You'll start to see the Wade numbers. You'll see the Butler numbers, from a three-point. You'll probably start to see that level off. Rondo's kind of holding up to his form from a shooting standpoint, yeah, as far as from what he's done. But he hasn't really had to been a guy that's to take over the game. It's really been running the offense and really playing through your two main guys, which is Butler and Wade.
One last question for you about the contract extensions and contract negotiations in general. Like the NBA, if you're a max guy, you're getting a max contract. There's obviously some wiggle room financially on some of these extensions, but are there sweeteners in these contracts? Like, can you like work in like, you know, guy gets 2-bedroom suite, the Ritz-Carlton in this city? I mean, are those types of kind of player riders in these contracts?
There are no, there are. If there are, it's done under the table, and okay. Nobody does it, knows about it. And I think when you look at the contracts, you know, basically you can put some incentives in there, some incentive laden, but you're limited, you know, from an unlikely bonus standpoint, you know, 15% of the per year value, and so there is some tour. You know, we saw it with Schroeder. There, you know, he's got $62 million guaranteed, $8 million in additional bonuses, but the $8 million in bonuses are, you know, a combination of games played. You know, Atlanta's got to, you know, go to the NBA Finals or win a championship, or he's got to make an All-Star game. So you can see certain things like that. I think there's about 33 players that have certain unlikely bonuses. Some are, you know, some are off the wall. Mirotić has one in that, you know, the Chicago's got to win 65 games and he gets like $800,000. And, you know, I mean, if you are in Golden State, maybe you have a chance, but that's something that's unlikely. But, you know, from a sweetener standpoint, it's a little bit different than maybe Major League Baseball when you can put something that you get a sweet for a game, you know, for a whole season. I think like Albert Pujols might have something in his deal.
So nothing like at the Moscow Marriott, you didn't have that in the Nets deals, like a free room for the Russians?
No, what we did was we gave a free alias for the whole year. That's what we did on the road.
There are some great, that's a conversation for a different day, but some of these travel guys and equipment managers use some phenomenal aliases on the road.
Well, quick one, real quick, you know, when I was working for the Nets, this is before I, you know, got into a management, I worked at a part-time job for one of these hotel companies, and basically I would wait for the visiting teams to come into the Renaissance Meadowlands, and I would be that guy who would walk the rooms before the team got there, so I'd make sure their lights are on, the keys worked, you know, everything, you know, so when the Celtics came in at 2 a.m, I would be their greeter as far as to hand out the keys and made some extra money. And the names that were on here, and a lot of players like to use movie names, you know, either from The Godfather or Goodfellas, or you know, even in New Jersey and Brooklyn, the names that you see, and when you go into a hotel, you know, kind of puts a smile on your face.
We've come a long way when teams are staying at the Renaissance in the Meadowlands, in that area, right? Does that still
happen? It's come a long way. You were at the Meadowlands, now you're in at the Barclays Center. So, but you didn't have much of a choice when you were playing at the old Continental Airlines Arena.
Yeah, I used to know, this is not exactly to do with the aliases, but I used to know a player, and I won't throw him under the bus, but he, to mess with one of the other guys, might have been a rookie or a second-year guy, somebody wanted to mess with, he would always take, when he went on the road, he would find that player's key, purposely take it, go upstairs, use his bathroom, and when I say use his bathroom, I mean use his bathroom, and then decline to flush afterwards, and then he would leave. This was, I heard that story like 4 or 5 years ago. I had it confirmed by a couple of the people whose bathroom he did use at that time. It was a go-to, and it was pretty gross, not going to lie.
Life on the road, you know?
Well, Bobby, I appreciate it, man. We'll catch up again soon.
Thanks, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks for joining the show. A reminder, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. If you like it, post a comment, give us a rating. You know I appreciate it. While you're there, check out The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and The Vertical Podcast with Woj. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.